Special Committee on Land Use Fairness for Thursday, April 12, 2007. I'll note that Representative Smith is out ill today, and so she's excused from this meeting. And then we have two Senate members who I think are excused for another commitment.
That's correct. Senator Schrader and Senator Johnson are part of the Ways and Means. The Ways and Means is our committee members know are on the road. This is more for those who are in attendance. They have been excused because they're currently in Bend with the Ways and Means presentations that are going on around the state, so they cannot be here tonight, and so they've been excused.
Our business this evening is an informational meeting to consider invited testimony only. There will be no public hearing this evening. And it will be a presentation on a framework for proposed amendments to Ballot Measure 37. And this is the product of a work group that has been laboring long and hard over these issues for a number of weeks. And at this point, I'd like to turn over to my co-chair, Senator Przanski, to describe that process.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Basically, as the committee members know, we as a committee have met approximately 13 times since January 23rd. On the February 23rd, we started a work group with five members of this committee meeting, and that work group met 14 times. During those 14 times that we met as a group, we had worked on facilitating some type of framework to move forward for maybe some type of resolutions in legislation. We have had in that work group, besides the two co-chairs, Senator Schrader, Representative Garrard, and Representative Smith. At the conclusion of those 14 meetings, we had a framework that we had worked on. It was not an agreement. It was nothing set in stone. It was only a framework as to how we were wanting to proceed and what we thought might be doable. At the same time, we had asked and had the involvement of the two individuals that would be doing the presentation tonight. They were our technical advisors, Lane Shutley from LCDC and Richard Whitman, who an attorney with the Department of Justice. They had been invited to be part of our technical support for the work group because of their expertise in the area. Also participating was our committee administrator, Mr. Brennan, and Patrick was there as our scrivener and making certain that we had notes as to what we had discussed. And what we have decided, Mr. Co-Chair, is that at this point we have asked that the two technicians who were working with us, oh, I should say there was one other person, our facilitator for the work group was Tim Nesbitt in the governor's office because of his expertise in facilitating work groups and negotiations. We felt that he would add an asset. And I want to thank everyone who participated in that process as we worked together to try to come together. And clearly, we have not completed that work as a work group because there have been some issues that have reached impasse, but we do have a framework, and it should be noted that tonight what we will be bringing forward will mirror part of what the group has done, but also will have some variations within some of the details as to some of the specifics.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Przanski. I'd now like to, before I actually move to our invited presenters, I should have said earlier, if you have a cell phone with you or a pager, please turn it off. It's not sufficient if it's in just the vibrate mode because we have sensitive sound equipment in this hearing room, and then it will pick up feedback or distortion as a result of those devices. So if you could please turn those devices off, we would be very appreciative. So I'll now invite Richard Whitman from the Department of Justice and Lane Shetterly from the Department of Land Conservation and Development.
Good evening. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, here at the co-chair's invitation this evening to set the stage and then also participate with Richard Whitman in the walkthrough of the framework as described by Co-Chair Przanski to the committee. Before getting into that, I thought I would just update you on a few things. It's been a few weeks since I've had the pleasure of being in front of the committee, and just wanted to let the committee know where things stand relative to the status of claims. When we have been before you in earlier meetings, we've expressed significant concern about the volume of claims that came in during that period, particularly in the 5 weeks before the December 4 change in process that occurred in the measure. You also heard testimony from Art Schlack of the Association of Oregon Counties expressing much the same concern, and I can tell you this evening that our concerns continue, and in fact, as we get closer to that point in time where we will not be able to meet the 180-day timeline on those claims that came in during the last portion of that period before December 4, it becomes more urgent that action be taken to alleviate that potential liability to the state and to counties that are in the same position as is the state. So what I've distributed to you this evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just briefly is a status report of the claims. I won't dwell on this. I know that your focus tonight is on the framework, but I wanted to set the stage in part with the report on where we are. We have 6,680 claims in at the Department of Administrative Services. 5,006 of those claims have been forwarded to agencies. Of those, over 4,900 have been referred to DLCD as the lead agency. Presently, of that total, 1,669 are still at DAS in their process. You have 2,669 claims that have been closed, including 2,593 final orders having been issued. So far to date, 3,067 claims have had neighbor letters sent, with a total of 59,504 letters going out on those. And you see at the bottom of that, just shy of $15 billion in total compensation, with an asterisk to the effect that does not reflect the total of all compensation, as the data entry has not been completed at DAS on the last claims that came in during those weeks before the December 4 deadline. So, Mr. Chair, that is the not very pretty picture of where we are in terms of claims processing, but I did want to bring the committee up to date on that. What we have before you this evening, Mr. Whitman, will walk you through a framework. I think, as the Senator Przanski described, is an effort, reflects an effort of the work group that met over the past several weeks to address the problems, uncertainties, and conflicts that exist in Ballot Measure 37 that have led and continue to lead to frustration both on the part of claimants, concerns on the part of neighbors, and, of course, state and local government as they seek to process the claims. That frustration and the confusion in the measure is reflected in the number of lawsuits that have been filed. Currently, I think Mr. Whitman can confirm, but I believe we are somewhere north of 160 lawsuits filed on claim decisions that have been made. As before, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, those lawsuits reflect a mix of suits both by disappointed claimants whose claims perhaps have been denied or whose waivers have not been as extensive as those claimants may have wished, but also an increasing number of actually of neighbor claims, where neighbors have filed action seeking review of claim decisions that we made in favor of a claimant. And one that sort of typifies where we are in this in terms of the confusion in the litigation arena is a claim decision we made out of Lane County, where we have been sued both by the claimant and the neighbors, all arising out of one decision. And so that is continuing, and what our work, it's been my pleasure and our pleasure to work with the co-chairs and the work group to begin to formulate some means of addressing these uncertainties and problems in the measure, and that will be reflected in the presentation of the framework from Mr. Whitman this evening. I think with that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my remarks and let Mr. Whitman begin to walk you through the framework, and then as we go, I think both of us will be happy to answer questions, engage in whatever discussion you feel appropriate to flesh out the framework as we're presenting it this evening.
Thank you, Mr. Shetterly. Mr. Whitman.
Thank you. For the record, Richard Whitman from the Oregon Department of Justice. Before I get into the framework, I do want to make just a few additional comments about the litigation and also the pending claims to supplement a couple of points that Mr. Shetterly made. First of all, on the claims front, as I think the committee knows, there was a very sharp peak of claims filed in November and early December of last year, approximately 3,000 plus claims filed in that 3 to 4 week period. So we are coming up on the 180-day deadline for approximately 3,000 plus claims. And once we start going beyond that 180-day deadline, we go beyond it for a very large number of claims, close to 3,000 very quickly. So that's one point that I wanted to make. On the litigation front, just two quick things, updates. First of all, in terms of the number of lawsuits pending, the number of approximately 160 lawsuits that are pending are the lawsuits that the state is a party to. There are a significant number of lawsuits pending also where local government has been sued. So the 160 is nowhere near the total number of lawsuits that have been filed concerning Measure 37. And then just a brief update in terms of significant decisions coming out of the court system on Measure 37. You had a presentation on this issue from Stephanie Striffler from the Department of Justice several months ago. There have been some decisions since then that are somewhat significant. There was one reported in the paper this week where we had our first decision from the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals in a case called DLCD versus Lee coming out of Jackson County that held that in rural areas anyway, claimants do need to file a claim and obtain a waiver from both the state of Oregon and from local government. So that's a somewhat significant case. And then the other update that I would give on the litigation front has to do with a case called Corey versus DLCD. This is a case decided by the Oregon Court of Appeals that I think Ms. Striffler reported on, where the Court of Appeals held that the state of Oregon is at least in many cases required to hold a hearing on each claim. And the state has petitioned for reconsideration in that case. It's pending before the Oregon Court of Appeals right now. We do have quite a bit of turmoil at the trial court level right now in terms of trying to figure out what happens to litigation that's already been filed in the circuit court or trial court level. If the state should have been holding hearings, administrative hearings on all those cases. So there's just a lot, there's significantly more confusion on that front than there was even a couple of months ago. So,
Mr. Co-Chair, point of clarification, Richard, on that last case, that's the Corey case. That's the one that was talking about a claimant having the right to contested hearings?
Yes, Chairman Pearson, Senator Brzezinski, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. So with that, let me describe to you the framework as it is being prepared and as Chair McPherson noted, Senator Brzezinski noted, there are some differences between what I'm going to describe tonight and the framework that was talked about in the work group. And I'll try to highlight those so that people are aware of those, where there are differences as I go through this. And let me start with Measure 37 itself in terms of what the framework would do with Measure 37 itself. In essence, the bill would take those group of claims that have already been approved and that are pending with government, and divide them into certain pathways. And one pathway, the words that are commonly used for this are the express path. I think people have heard those terms before. Another path would be a conditional path. I'm going to come back and talk about each of these in a little bit more detail. And then a third path would be a path for Measure 37 claimants who believe that they have rights under Measure 37 that are vested. They would continue under Measure 37. So let me talk about the express path. The express path would apply to claimants who own property outside of an urban growth boundary, who wish to proceed with the development of anywhere between 1 and 3 home sites on their property. And claimants would be able to opt into this category if they want to, but they wouldn't be able to increase the number of home sites if they've already filed a claim. So if somebody's filed a claim for 1 home site with government already, they wouldn't be able to increase that to 3, but if they've filed a claim for 5, they could come down to 3 to get into this pathway. There are 5 basic requirements for a property owner to fit within this express pathway. In most of these, this is all designed to be as objective, easily determined as possible, so that the process for having these people go forward would be as fast and as simple as can be. The first of the 5 criterion are that the claimant has to own the property. Many of these are things that are already required under Measure 37. So the claimant has to be shown to own the property. That's number 1. Number 2, the date that the claimant acquired the property on would have to be before March 1, 1994. And we didn't just pick that date out. The work group didn't just pick that out of thin air. There's a history and a reason to that date. That is the date that the $80,000 income test went into effect under LCDC rules. Some of you may remember that. And then shortly before that, the legislature also adopted the acreage limits for uses on farm and forest lands. So the purpose of the 1994 date was to try to capture everybody who has been affected by those land use regulations. Third requirement, the property would have to be outside an urban growth boundary. This is dealing with rural claims. I'll get to the urban claims a little bit later. The fourth basic requirement would be that the claimant show that he or she had the right to establish that number of home sites on the property when he or she acquired the property, a core element of Measure 37 that would be continued. And then the fifth requirement really just deals with folks who filed their claims after December of 06. They would have to show that they comply with the language of Measure 37 that says if you didn't file your claim within that first 2-year period, you show that you've applied for the use and have been denied. So those are the basic 5 criterion for the express pathway. So anybody who can demonstrate that they meet those 5 would be authorized to proceed with the development of that number of home sites on their property. There's some other details here in terms of transferability, in terms of development standards. I'm going to come to those a little bit later because they apply to both pathways. So let me talk now about the conditional pathway. So for claimants who do not want to go under the express pathway and who believe that they've been harmed in some manner that is greater than the relief that they would receive under the express pathway, the second route would be open to them. They would have to show the same things that the individual under the express pathway would show, those same 5 requirements, plus 2 additional things. First of all, this pathway would not be provided for property owners whose property is located on high-value farmland or within what we're calling a groundwater-restricted area. And let me talk about each of those in a little bit of detail. On the high-value farmland piece, that is the existing definition of high-value farmland that's in the farm use statutes in ORS Chapter 215 with two things added to it. One would be the an area of land that's commonly known as harbor bench land, which is down outside of the city of Brookings in Curry County, where there's a large amount of lily growing. That category of land would be added. People who have claims within that area of land still would be able to make claims under the express pathway that I talked about, but would not be able to come in under this. And then the other area of land that would be added would be areas that have been designated as viticultural areas by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and that also meet certain criteria in terms of slope and orientation that essentially make them suitable for as vineyard land. So two additions to the existing high-value farmland, the harbor bench, and then the vineyard land. Groundwater restricted areas is fairly straightforward. It's two types of areas that have been designated either by the Oregon Water Resources Commission or maybe in some cases by the Water Resources Department, critical groundwater areas and what are known as groundwater limited areas. Those areas also could not come in under this conditional pathway. And you had a presentation earlier by Jim Johnson from the Oregon Department of Agriculture where he showed you maps of those areas as they've been designated by the Water Resources Commission or Department. So, again, on the conditional path, you have to show the same five things as under the express, plus you can't be in high-value farmland or a groundwater-restricted area. And then the other key, and this is the other key requirement for the conditional pathway, is that you would have to show that you have the value of your property was reduced by the enactment of one or more land use regulations in an amount that is comparable to the value of the number of home sites that you want to establish. And I think the best way to think about this is the policy notion behind this is you are, in essence, compensating people who have been harmed by land use regulations by providing them a number of home sites that is comparable in value to what the harm was. There is a cap on this, and the cap is 10. So this would be for the relief that would be provided under this pathway would authorize between 4 and 10 home sites. And this is one area of difference with some of the framework that had been talked about in the work group. The framework in the work group would have had individuals show that they have been harmed by they would have had to show an amount of harm that was equivalent to at least the value of 3 home sites. And if they were able to show that amount of harm, they would then be provided an authorization for a number of home sites that's based on a matrix that's dependent on the area of the property, the number of acres in the property. So the more acreage you had, the more number of home sites. There wouldn't have necessarily been a direct correlation between the amount of the loss and the number of home sites. All right. So those are the main attributes of the conditional pathway and the express pathway. The basic process that would be used to get from where we are now under Measure 37 to relief under this new authorization for development in rural areas is that the state would send notice to all claimants describing what choices the claimants have under this legislation and telling the claimants what, if any, additional information would be needed. And the claimants would then have a period of time, probably 90 days, in which to choose which of these pathways they wish to proceed under. DLCD would then process the claims in the order received. And at the end of that that process, DLCD would then issue an order that would say, you, property owner, are authorized to build a specific number of home sites, develop a specific number of home sites on the property. That's one major point that I want to point out here, and this is true of the framework. It's true of what I'm describing tonight, and it's a difference from Measure 37 in that at the end of the claims process, property owners would know specifically how many home sites they're authorized to proceed with on their property. Okay. I'm going to talk a little bit about development standards and transferability now. First of all, development standards. This authorization to develop home sites on the property, individuals would still need to comply with current development standards, state and local land use regulations that have development standards, unless those would effectively prohibit the use, in which case they would not have to comply with them. So, for instance, if there's a setback on a property that says you can't build within a certain distance of a boundary of the property, you would have to comply with that setback unless you can show that because of that setback you couldn't build at all, in which case it wouldn't apply. There would also be development standards in terms of acreage of any new lots or parcels that are created and requirements in terms of clustering. So in general, if the property is high-value farmland, then the any new lots or parcels that are created on the property would have to be 2 acres, would have a maximum size of 2 acres. If it was not high-value farmland, then the maximum size would be 5 acres. And I think this is another area where there's a little bit of difference between this and some of what was talked about on the framework. Any dwellings that are developed on the property would need to avoid the portion of the property that is in high-value farmland soils, if there are such soils on the property. And then finally, one other element in terms of clustering. If a particular person has several claims, so if a claimant has 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 claims, the claimant could have all the development occur on one property if they wanted. They could cluster it on one property, but in order to do that, that property would have to be the least suitable for a resource use, farm or forest use.
The development standards would not be applied so as to prohibit a use. Okay. That's important.
Okay. Okay, let me talk about transferability now. And there are a couple of aspects to this. Let me start with an issue that you've heard about in terms of testimony to the committee, public testimony. This is concerns of individuals who are concerned that if a claimant passes away right now under Measure 37, that the rights of that individual under Measure 37, we believe, are lost, and that the heirs of that individual would have a new acquisition date and a very different set of rights under Measure 37. So one provision of this bill, I think reflecting the fact that it's going to take a little bit of time to work all this through, is that we would have a provision that says that if in the event that a claimant does pass away, that their heirs would step into the shoes of the claimants and have the same rights, the same acquisition date that the claimant has. Then, also related to transferability, this legislation would specify that the rights, the development authorizations that I've just described are fully transferable, so that if an individual has these rights and wants to sell the property now and take that money and have somebody else carry out the development of the property, that can be done. They're fully transferable. There would be no time limit on when the development would have to occur as long as the claimant owns the property. But once the claimant conveys the property, sells the property, there then would be a 10-year period during which the purchaser of the property would have to carry that development out within that 10 years. So somewhat of a time limit on when the development would occur. Okay. That's it on the rural claims in terms of description under the framework. Let me move now to the urban part of the framework.
If I could,
yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just one thing. I'm not sure. I may have missed it, but there is an aspect of this whereby under the proposed legislation, claims would be submitted to the state. The counties would be relieved of the obligation to process duplicate claims, essentially. What we have now is where you have one property located in a rural area. Property owner is required to file a claim on the same property, both with the state and also with the county. The legislation as proposed would consolidate that claims process with the state, thereby relieving the counties of that claims processing function and also simplifying then the filing by claimant so there's only one filing.
And, Mr. Chair, one other thing I just remembered that I left out, which is there is another cap in this bill, which is an overall cap that applies to a person in the state of Oregon in terms of the maximum number of home sites that any one person could develop under the authorizations under this legislation. That cap is 20. Okay, urban claims. For urban areas, and these are areas within urban growth boundaries again, to qualify. Well, the basic relief that would be provided in urban areas is that individuals would be authorized to establish one or more dwellings within an urban area. To qualify for that authorization, the claimant, again, would have to show that they're the owner of the property and that all the owners of the property have consented to the claim. As I just mentioned, the property would have to be within an urban growth boundary. This only applies to property that is zoned for residential use. The land use regulations in question must have prohibited the development of a dwelling. And then, again, the core element of existing Measure 37, the claimant must have had the right to establish that dwelling or dwellings on the property when the claimant acquired the property. Within cities or within urban areas, we would flip, if you will, the processing of these so that it's handled at the local level and not the state level. And I think the thinking is that this reflects sort of the balance between state and local regulation. In the rural areas, you've got a lot of state law that is effectively driving what happens. In urban areas, state law doesn't, for the most part, set specific requirements for what happens in urban areas. So the processing of these claims would be left to cities. And then in those few cases where you have land within an urban growth boundary that's not within an incorporated city, the county would handle the processing of that. So that's the urban part of this. One thing that is implicit in what I've said, but I'll go ahead and make it explicit now, these authorizations are authorizations for residential development of property. And that's true both in rural areas and in urban areas. One thing under this legislation is that it would focus the authorizations on residential use of property. For commercial and industrial development, basically the option would be to proceed under whatever rights they've already got under Measure 37. But the main focus of this is just on authorizing residential use of property.
And that is something of a departure from the framework, I think,
yes,
as was
thank
presented.
You. That's what I was thinking, Mr. Setterly. That is a bit of a departure from the framework. In the framework, we were looking at some very limited authorization of commercial development on rural lands. Okay. The next part of the framework has to do with new land use regulations and Measure 37 going forward. The framework would continue Measure 37 going forward. For land use regulations that restrict the residential use of real property and land use regulations that restrict farm practices or forest practices. So those aspects of Measure 37 would continue in the future. There would, however, be a threshold, and this is an area where there was not finality in terms of the framework. Let me put it that way. So there would be a threshold going forward, and the threshold would be 20%. The property owner would have to show a reduction in the fair market value of the property of 20% or more in order to have a claim going forward.
Just, Mr. Chair, just for reference on that, again, that number comes from a look across the states that have similar laws as ballot measure 37 already in force. I think we found that 20% was the lowest threshold that was required under any of those other states with measures similar to measure 37.
Yes, Mr. Setterly, Mr. Chair, there are three other states who have specific percentage thresholds for this type of claim. They are Texas, Mississippi, and Louisiana, and they're percentages are 20%, 25%, and 40%. So that just gives a little bit of context. There are, however, I'll point out, other states that have recently enacted legislation by initiative that have no threshold. Let me talk a little bit about, in this framework obviously includes valuation is a central element of it. And so in terms of valuation, the test for reduction in value would be a real test. People would have to show a real loss in terms of the effect of the enactment of a land use regulation on their property. The other parts of this framework include really a lot of cleanup work in terms of process for claims review, some cleanup in terms of coordination between state and local government, things that aren't addressed in Measure 37 right now, some clarity in terms of how judicial review works for if people disagree with decisions that are made by government. Under this legislation, provisions that would set up an office of an ombudsman to assist claimants in with the process of looking at whether they really have a valid claim or not, and then also would be authorized to, in certain circumstances, mediate between government and claimants if there are disputes over particular issues. And then last but not necessarily least, this would also include an emergency clause. And so it would go into effect immediately upon enactment. Those are the main elements of the legislation. I believe that I have highlighted the main areas of departure, but I'm not sure I've caught all of them.
Mr. Chair,
Saturday?
Members of the committee, there's one other area I think it would be fair to highlight in terms of difference, what you're hearing tonight from what was released a couple of weeks ago as the written summary of the framework at that time. And that was, I think, in the written framework, provision for limited liability companies, for family limited liability companies that would have allowed family-owned limited liability companies to tack back in time to the date that the individual who established or is currently a member of that limited liability company first acquired an interest in the property. That is not present in this framework for those limited liability companies. The spousal provision, though, is maintained in the framework the current iteration of the framework, so that if you have the scenario whereby an individual acquired property in, let's say, his name, he then married and only later after the marriage date, perhaps even not until his death, passed the property to his spouse, she would be deemed under current interpretation of Measure 37 not to have acquired an interest in the property until that date that the husband passed away and she inherited the property, given that Oregon is not a community property state. The current iteration of the framework would continue what was proposed earlier, and that would allow the spouse in that scenario to also tack back, in this case, to the date of marriage,
that's right,
to establish her rights as an owner of the property for the purpose of a Measure 37 claim.
Thank you, Mr. Shetterly. Thank you, Mr. Whitman.
Welcome.
Representative Garrard, do you have a question?
Just three things, and Richard, I'll just go over it very quickly. I thought on the multiple claims, the total number of dwellings that have been discussed was 30 and not 20.
Yes, Chair McPherson, Representative Garrard, that's right. That is a point of departure in terms of 20 instead of 30.
That's correct. Follow, Mr. Chair.
You may.
The ombudsman portion was never, to my knowledge, discussed in the work group.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, I think there may have been some discussion about that early on. It was never decided, certainly, that it would be a part of the framework. So, yes, in that sense, this is a piece that was not part of the framework.
And one final. Mm-hmm. And the only threshold number that I ever recall seeing was 25%, not 20.
Chair McPherson, Representative Garrard, I just don't remember in terms of that number what numbers were discussed. I think there were a variety of numbers discussed at various times.
Co-Chair Brzozinski, why don't you comment on
that? There was a variation. At one point I know with the group when we did not come to a conclusion was 15 to 25.
Right.
And the decision after our last meeting is with all five of us, it was decided to move forward with the 20.
I must have been having pizza or something.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair. We didn't go into much detail on this one, but I understand the counties would be taken out of the process. It would go just to the state when you're filing your claim. The 180-day goes away, or what happens with the 180 days and with those kinds of ramifications?
Yeah. Chair McPherson, Representative Roblin, the counties are out of the decision-making process in terms of the decision of whether a claimant is entitled to relief under this legislation. The counties are still included in the sense that they would be receiving notice and would be asked to comment on the claims and so have input into whether there are any, in particular, whether there are any local land use regulations that affect the claim.
And also on that, if I may, before he goes on to the next one, Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, also the counties would be involved still the same way in the post-waiver process where the claimant would present the waiver essentially to the county planning department, and the county would then have the same authority to proceed with the development application as they currently do.
Okay. And then, Chair McPherson, Representative Roblin, in terms of the 180-day provision in Measure 37, yes, that would, part of the amendments to Measure 37 would be that would be taken out and replaced with different process requirements that, again, as I described briefly, but I'll go into a little more detail now, would have the state providing notice to all the claimants, both those with approved claims and those with pending claims, within a specified period of their right to choose which of these authorizations they want. They would then have a period of 90 days to make their choice as to what they want to do. And then the state would be required to process those choices, if you will, in the order received as expeditiously as possible. There would be, with regard to the conditional path, since we would be requiring appraisals in order for people to demonstrate that they have lost value, those claimants would be given a little bit more time, recognizing that it's going to take some time for them to go out and get an appraisal and come back with that.
Senator Brzozinski.
And just following up on that, it is understood that with those who are going into the express path, that those claims could be processed much quicker than those that had to go through the conditional with the appraisal, just because of the time frame of seeking that and presenting it. But one of the things we wanted to make certain is that we understand the burden that the counties have, and we felt that the process of having the state take over the evaluation of the claim in the sense of determining it would actually relieve a lot of pressure there at the county level, but still require for their input and also the follow-up that once the claimant received the number authorized for home site development, then they would be dealing directly with their local officials as to carrying out that development.
And Mr. Chair, if I may just elaborate on that, that's a very significant element, I think, of this in practical terms, because what people get now in the way of a waiver from the state is because we don't receive specific development applications, the information that comes to the state in the waiver application is really very general. Typically what people get would be a decision that says that Goal 3 is not applicable to allow the person to develop residential dwellings on their property according to its terms as of, and then you might insert a date that the person acquired the property. That really doesn't tell them what they get. They have to go back to the county. The county has to make research then what was Goal 3 in effect in 1976, 1978, whatever the date of the acquisition of the property may be, and only through a much more labor-intensive process do they ever learn what their actual development rights would be. Here, they would get a waiver that actually identifies the number of dwelling home sites that they would get. They take that to the county, and the county could process that much more expeditiously than what they have right now in the way of a waiver.
Representative Garrard.
Lane, in regard to those claims that have been filed, the express lane, how many of those existing claims could be taken care of by using the express lane of 1 to 3 dwellings?
Chair McPherson, Representative Garrard, I believe the numbers, we have numbers from the Portland State University database, which show, based on that database, that in terms of the number who have requested 1 to 3 is, I believe, in the 30% range. It looks like Senator Brzozinski has the table there. And so somewhere in the 30% range.
For clarification, based on what we received, based on where this came from, individuals wanting 1 to 3 would be 40% of the claims. Those wanting 4 to 9 would be an additional 31.3. So in that 1%. Combining those together, you're talking about 71%+ of the claims.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, the reason I hesitated on that is that, just to be clear, those percentages are based on incomplete numbers because, again, not all of the claims have been processed to that. So I want to make that disclaimer, although if you extrapolate those numbers, they're from a high enough sample that there's probably a good degree of reliability. Also, your question was how many claims could And that does at least invite the comment that, to underscore what Mr. Whitman said, that a claimant who may have filed a claim for more than three would have the ability to basically amend their claim and move themselves into that express line. And I think anecdotally we are satisfied that there's at least a significant number of claims that are seeking an extent of waiver that may be well beyond what the claimant actually intends to develop. They may have been encouraged by a consultant or by legal counsel, or they may have just figured it out on their own that this is the time to maximize their opportunity when they file that claim. So that's why those numbers are not probably entirely reliable, but when you take into account the fact that more people could move from a 4 to 9 sized claim down to the express lane to 3, you may even see those percentages go up.
And just for clarification regarding this information, that's based on, as we understand from PSU's review of the 9 Willamette Valley counties. And so it is a pretty significant number of claims that have been filed are in the Willamette Valley, but as our technicians have said, that's, you know, these are just based on this estimate with some extrapolation.
Any further questions from the committee? Well, if not, then I'll excuse our two witnesses.
Thank
and thank you very
sure.
much, gentlemen, for that presentation. That concludes the invited testimony for this informational session. As I mentioned at the beginning, we'll take no public testimony this evening. Their notice has been set for a meeting, though, at our next scheduled meeting time, which is next Tuesday. That must be the 17th of April, at which several bills have been set for public hearing. So public testimony will be received then. But just a word of caution, the substance of the we were receiving testimony on is the substance that reflects this framework and not the original substance of those bills. So if you're coming to testify that evening, don't come to offer testimony on the original bills that are set in that notice as introduced, but rather on the substance of what was presented here this evening in the framework for Measure 37 amendments. Thank you very much, committee, for your attendance. We're adjourned.